Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. Today, we're diving into the world of human connectedness in the evolving workspace with Julia Habsbaum, futurist of work, Bloomberg columnist, and author. She was researching and speaking about the importance of human connectedness long before it became a necessary and popular topic during the pandemic. It's people like Julia who are helping us find a better way to thrive in the workplace. In a world that's rapidly changing and presenting new challenges every day, we find ourselves having to rethink the ways we connect. With her focus on social health and learning to thrive in an age of overload, Julia is the perfect guide to help us navigate these complex waters. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Hi, Julia. Thanks so much for joining us on Let Go and Lead.
Oh, my pleasure. Nice to see you. I wish I was seeing you in person.
Oh, I know. Same. But I'm glad at least we could do it by distance, right? So, you and I have had many opportunities to talk, and I know we share so many philosophies, and it's just so exciting to get you on the podcast. I particularly love is that you've researched and studied connectivity for many, many years, way before this became a popular topic. And of course, with the pandemic and all the attention to everything happening, you became a global sensation.
Hardly, but I did touch on stuff that people were interested in. Yeah, lucky.
You know, one of the things I'd love to ask you, and I mentioned you've been all over the world, what are you seeing as differences around the world in terms of the way leaders are thinking about how people connect?
Well, thank you for having me and for focusing in on connectivity and leadership, actually, because I've been talking a lot lately, as you know, about the office and work specifically. But the underlying issue that comes up again and again and again all over the world is how people communicate and connect. So one of the things that's universal since the pandemic is a sense of anxiety and crisis around how people can get together and collaborate and connect and not be isolated and lonely. But what I found is that this was a problem that was happening before the pandemic anyway. It was masked by the norms and the commute and the everybody into the office, etc. But in fact, lots of people were feeling disconnected, alienated, and therefore not productive. So I suppose if I want to generalize, it's that everybody knows the cat is out of the bag now. We're talking about what great social health, as I call it, means, the state of healthy connection between people and people and people and effectively computers. And of course, AI coming into the mix now has made it a whole lot more complicated because it's brought many, many conveniences, but it's also brought a new crisis of trust. Who are you talking to? Who do you believe? Are you talking to somebody that you know or somebody that's simulating a person, etc.? So it was never easy and it's actually got more complicated.
And are you seeing a big difference globally from country to country in terms of how people are thinking about the ways people work?
Yes, I was just talking to somebody today who I interviewed for my podcast about work, who runs an academic think tank. And we were agreeing that what we would love to see is a global dashboard, the kind of thing that a hedge fund manager would use of showing different commodities. There's a lack of tracking of the different countries. You have to really work hard to piece it together. And my main knowledge areas are America and the UK. But that said, the data sets and the connections I've gotten, some of the talks I've been giving really for the last 6 or 7 years in particular, show that there are definitely local, regional, nationalist differences, but that the overall trend is pretty similar. Why? Because we're in a globalized world. The technology is the same. The HR practices are the same. The leadership systems are broadly speaking the same. So the irony is, I think now is a brilliant opportunity for people to start to act local, to act to think local and act local and almost deglobalize when it comes to managing their own issues around connectivity, productivity, and if you like, the work-life issues around the workplace.
You know, one of the things I realize is I should have started out by introducing your book just so that we had the context for this.
Am I allowed to say which one? Slightly smugly, you know, I'm about to finish. In fact, when I get off this call, I'm racing back to my desk because I'm on deadline to finish my fourth book in 7 years. So don't let anyone tell you the pandemic didn't make anyone productive, because I'm telling you, it worked for me. So which book do you mean?
So I'm going to start by saying, in addition, you're the author of several books, The Simplicity Principle, Connectivity, and The Nowhere Office.
Yes.
So one of the things, of course, I'm very interested in talking to you about is all the trends on returning to the office or not.
Yes, exactly. So what started all of this off? Because I was a sort of humble entrepreneur running effectively a small media publishing and events business for many, many years. And before that, I was in public relations. I just have always been interested in connectivity and what I would call connectedness and the relationship between people and machines. You know, I'm old enough, I'm hashtag only 59, but I'm old enough to go back to the analog age. And we are now drowning in a sea of overload. So actually, the book that really began my writing career was, there had been a couple of books before that, but the one that I guess took off was a book called Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in an Age of Overload. And then the paperback came out and the title was Social Health in an Age of Overload. Then I wrote The Simplicity Principle. Then I wrote The Nowhere Office. And actually, apropos connection, they are all connected. I mean, God forbid I'd be accused of self-plagiarism, but the truth is, if you read those books next to each other, you know, I do recur different themes, hopefully not identical sentences, but the point is, I'm interested in these issues and I return to them not as a novelist does or a singer does, but as a nonfiction writer, I return to the same themes again and again and again. And the core theme for me is, why don't people get real about how work and life is for them? And why do they overlay and mask and obfuscate and therefore badly lead and badly manage? Something of an obsession of mine.
And what have you found to be the answer to that?
Well, the answer to that is not to, I'm almost jumping to your traditional last question. I think the answer to bad management and bad leadership is not to believe in any hubris, especially not your own, and that when the facts change, to change your mind. I think what's happening over at Harvard and the elite universities at the moment is a really interesting object lesson in terrible communications and very poor leadership, which is entrenchment in the face of disaster. And I think that that is very, very common as a response to bureaucracies. And what interests me is, how do you balance the tension between the individual and the at-scale organization? And the answer is, you have to really listen and iterate and change and U-turn and go short-term, not long-term, I believe.
Right. And you've talked so much about social health, and you mentioned it a few minutes ago. Why don't you just share with our listeners a little bit about that and your thinking around that?
It's interesting because I got interested in all of this when I got sick physically with burnout. I had lots of children. I had stepchildren, my own business. Like a lot of people, I went on holiday and I fell apart physically. This was many years ago now. I got really sick. I got pneumonia and sepsis, and I very, very nearly died.
Oh my gosh.
And
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And actually, years and years later, it turns out I have some sort of immune condition. So I've actually ended up being very interested in health because I don't have great health. And as I recovered from this, physical ordeal, I got interested in that whole question about health, physical health, mental health, recovery, stress. And I started reading up about the origins of the World Health Organization. And it occurred to me that given that so much of leadership is about, coming up with new ideas and freshness and agile and, new mantras, that the concept of health hadn't been changed since 1948, when the UN, subset of the UN, created the World Health Organization, which is that health is, and I quote, etched in my memory, the presence of physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of injury and disease. And I thought, okay, great. I'd come from the world of PR, and I'd been very interested in the enshrined definition of public relations. And I thought, that is fascinating, because at that point in time, which was around about 2015, I thought, well, we haven't updated that definition from before the 1950s for the age of the computer. So social well-being meant class, it meant poverty, it meant literally whether your physical health was impacted by whether you had enough nutrition, effectively. But by 2015, we were all highly literate, or getting literate, about carbs and calories and physical health. And there was a real step up, no pun intended, in our sense of detail. And I thought, but we haven't done the same for how we connect to media, to social media, to computers, our access, how much we're on it, too much or not at all. And that's what began my thinking about it. And I called it social health. And, I've actually tweaked the definition several times, Meryl. I can't quite ever decide on the totally final. But, the gist is what I said at the beginning. It's how do humans connect to each other and connect to technology in a way that is productive and fulfilling? That's social health. And I don't think we focus enough on it. And I don't think, just to wrap this thought, I don't think well-being has ever completely covered it or moved the needle. I think we need a slightly harder edge to the discussion, which we are having now post-pandemic.
I love that you keep tweaking the definition, because society keeps changing. Why wouldn't your definition of social change?
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Thank you.
If you wrote The Nowhere Office, I understand that you came at it from a point of view that you'd been developing much earlier. And obviously the time became right, but what really triggered the book?
So I'd been running my own business. I'd been a consultant for many, many years. I've been a strategist and a consultant, and management and leadership had always interested me ever since I'd, met slightly accidentally on my travels some of the great management thinkers and writers, including Charles Handy, who remains a great friend of mine. And I've always thought it was underrated in terms of dealing with social problems. How does a management mindset and leadership and the history and stories affect things? So I've been noodling away at that. And in my career, which has been a little bit unorthodox, don't have a degree, been a visiting professor in a number of places, worked across a lot of industries, and I'm quite social and extrovert, I've been in a lot of businesses and offices and spaces. And I've always noticed that people were basically pretty unhappy in the workplace, and that the workplace was pretty dysfunctional. And I used to talk about this, and people would just sort of go, what are you talking about? Yeah, but no, but. I was getting no traction at all. And it didn't really matter, because I didn't have any skin in the game. I was doing the job I was hired to do, going into these offices and what have you. But it bothered me. And then the pandemic hit, and I sat in this room promoting the simplicity principle that came out about 4 days after stay put notices all over the world. Thank you very much, fate. So I sat in my home studio giving a million interviews for about 6 months. And then I just woke up one morning and I literally felt the kind of writerly itch to scratch. It's the best way I can describe it. I was still running my network at that point. I was pivoting to WhatsApp. I was changing lots of thoughts I'd had and about networks and connectivity, which we can talk about. But I woke up one morning and I thought, everything I've been feeling for the last 25 years is happening, which is people do not like living and working like this anymore, and they're not going to do it. I just knew, I felt that. I was reading a lot of data. I was just, anyway, so I pitched it as an idea to a think tank. I said, listen, I'll write a paper for you. I'll convene some voices for you. I'll keep my IP. I'll turn it into a book. What do you say? And it was possibly because I pitched it to a great woman. Nothing like talking to a great woman to get great stuff done. No disrespect to the men, but some of the best quick decisions in life have been made in my life by fabulous women. And she said, yes. And we were off to the races. So I wrote a paper that was published in, called The Nowhere Office, came out in, I think it was March 21, so mid-pandemic. And it got a lot of pickup, you know, Financial Times and The Economist wrote a whole page about it. And pretty much everyone was kind of, oh, this is terribly fascinating. What a depressing image. This is never going to happen. And I phoned up my agent and I said, you know, do you want to make a bet? You know, book agents are sort of like air traffic controllers, you know, they take the slot. And she was fabulous. And she took the slot, had a book publishing deal. And all the time while I was writing the book, everyone was going, yeah, but I mean, everyone's going to go back to the office. And I just kept reading, kept writing, kept remembering those faces in those offices year after year after year. And I thought, they're not going back. And I've got to say, you know, it's a really evolving landscape, but, you know, I knew what I was talking about. And we are in the middle of the biggest crisis of certainly white collar work in at least 100 years. So in work for 100 years, you know, and white collar work for as long as we've had it.
Don't you think it really took the pandemic to really make this change happen? Because even the companies that were enlightened in trying to change the way people work, we're asymmetrical to everybody else. So it seems like it was a great benefit that we all had to shift at once to prove the concept.
Yes. And one of the things I love about the concept of this show, you know, Let Go and Lead, is you have to let go. It's about not being in control. It's about recognizing what's the deal here and then responding, you know. And the best leadership stories are the simplest ones. I mean, I'm actually rather impressed by the story of Henry Ford introducing the five-day week in 2026. And before that, the $5 a day. I know there's lots of negative things you can say about Henry Ford, but actually, you know, Fordism and this, the moment 100 or so years ago when we experienced mass automation and mass production and mass consumerism and all the things that we're arguably living through now with AI a century later was actually very much about Henry Ford. He didn't like to do it with the trade unions, but ultimately reading the room. And one of the things he read in the room was you cannot work workers endlessly and exhaust them and not pay them well. And then they won't even have the energy to buy your products. You know, so I think that what we should all be looking for are the bright spot leaders who do good things because it's staring them in the face. And they don't behave like a pack animal. They don't get defensive and they don't make mistakes. No one size fits all when it comes to going back to work. It's a hugely complicated area. So I'm not advocating, even though I wrote the simplicity principle, I'm really advocating now the complexity principle when it comes to the workplace. But what I am saying is look for what your own workplace needs and your people need, and don't do what everybody else is doing just because you think there's a safety in that. That's a mistake.
That's a great piece of advice. So what are some of the specific ways that leaders can create strong connections for hybrid or remote teams?
Well, one of the things I think leaders need to do, and this will be music to your ears, is let go and lead. Let go of the idea that there is a fixed norm that is the right way to do it, because it's workplace by workplace. And what that means is don't over-index the discussion around culture and connection, because in the end, what people want from work before they get to connection, community, culture is, I think, I haven't read any data to the contrary, is they want fairness, they want good pay, they want good management, they increasingly, if they're young, want purpose. They don't want the commute if they don't need the commute. So the first thing is fix the right stuff first, I would say. When it comes to culture and community and connection, be very clear what you need technology to do where workplace technology is better than home-based and remote-based technology, because there's a big spectrum of difference there. And when you want people in because you believe that collaboration, rather than presenteeism for its own sake, because they're very different things, when you believe, depending on your industry or your culture, that you really want people in, then you figure out a modus vivendi that feels right and fair, and then you try it. You know, a very senior establishment institution corporate executive saw me at a party at Christmas, and he said he moaned about hybrid working and how annoying it was and how difficult it was. And, you know, I put on my you know, head on one side face. And actually, it is hard. It's tremendously hard to get right for leaders. But he was really moaning about it, as if how annoying that workers don't want to come in all the time. And he said, I've decided that maybe we'll move from the 2 to 3 days a week to a more shift-based, you know, 7, 8, 9 days in and then 5 days off. I think that's a good idea. What do you think? And I said, well, I think you could ask them and you could try it out. And then you could give them a window that isn't really a consultation window. It's a concern window where people can genuinely come and say, well, that's great, but my childcare doesn't work like that, or my partner's schedule doesn't work like that, or whatever. And he looked really surprised, because leaders think often that leading is being decisive rather than saying, well, we're in new territory, let's be in the territory together. So that's the kind of, I would just give that as the caveat, that the framework is a phrase that used to be mocked, which I always thought was rather brilliant, regardless of who said it, which is the known unknowns by Donald Rumsfeld. You know, we're in known unknown territory. So that's the baseline. Fix the big stuff first. Be prepared to do what needs to be done rather than what, you know, your colleagues think is the right thing, or you've been trained with your MBA to think is a decisive way to behave. But then community is about sharing. And actually, I've said since the beginning of the pandemic that I think that people need workplaces that aren't about doing the job. If you've got a workplace where arguably the work can be semi-delivered or comprehensively delivered externally, then the workplace has got to be for one or two or three of three things. And they are, one, to be social, to break bread, to get to the water cooler, to gossip, to just notice, oh, he's lost weight. She looks unhappy. Oh, they look great. You know, the social. The second is to learn. There's a lot of reskilling and learning and sharing, and intergenerationally, it's very important. And I'm sure you'll want to talk about the young versus the older generations. And then the third reason, which I think is super important, is it's really important to argue face-to-face, to disagree face-to-face, to say, Houston, we've got a problem. I want to talk to you about that. I don't like this workload, or I don't like this, or this isn't working, or what about if? So there are lots of reasons to come together, but the leader needs to be clear what they are. And often leaders, I'm finding, they're not. They're running around. I mean, no disrespect, there are some great leaders, some leaders who are learners, some leaders who are inspiring. I'm not knocking leaders per se, but an awful lot of leaders have been running around like headless chickens. And you only have to see that in the stop, start, go back to work, don't go back to the office, unlimited time off, I mean, that's not making anybody feel stable.
No, I completely agree. Our firm has been operating under the principle for 25 years of be where you need to be, and only you know where you need to be. And it's worked very well.
Yeah.
But it does take new thinking around how we connect and how we operate together. You know, I'm interested too in your thoughts. You know, often when we talk about people working together, it's under the assumption that everyone was in the same office in the first place.
Yeah.
And a lot of companies obviously have global teams or regional teams that never have been in the same place.
Exactly.
And have managed to do like really connect and drive and be productive all the while.
I agree completely with your point that we slightly fantasize that everybody was in the same office all the time. I mean, America employs more people than any other country outside of America. Okay. The corporate world remains largely American with American values. And you've got an awful lot of people that are either expatriate or in different time zones. And I was talking to the New York Stern Business School academic Arpit Gupta, whose research into real estate, he coined the phrase the doom loop, about plummeting real estate revenues. You know, he's talking a lot about time zone adjacency, that people are making their decisions and their businesses based on, is it practical to, you know, to have meetings like this call is de facto a meeting. And I've established with your excellent team that we're all in different time zones. There's, you know, a bunch of different time zones. So it has always been a bit of a myth that people were in the same office at the same time. Nevertheless, I am sympathetic to leaders of large and small enterprises alike who have felt that getting corporate community back together was a bit like herding cats. And it's absolutely true that you can't have anarchy either. Anarchy is not a productive state. It's destructive. It's anarchic. So you do need rhythms and patterns, but you just don't need to make them set based on plucked out of the air ether ideas because you think you learned to do it like a good leader. That's a very bad decision.
I think that's a great point. And I've heard you speak to this before as well, as to not look around at what other companies are doing, but figure out what you need for your own business. You know, because we're seeing a lot of companies wanting to benchmark and see what other businesses are doing so they can be very similar, rather than looking at what are our specific needs and how do we best make that available.
I mean, I'm very struck by the current crisis in elite institutions in America, the scandal at Harvard University at the moment. And I'm struck by effectively groupthink that has meant that a worldwide institution has been brought low by not an individual leader, but a leadership cohort that has literally been unable, as I understand it, to walk away or walk around or walk through a complex problem. And we need to learn from these examples. We need to understand that leadership is not about clinging to a group of apparently like-minded individuals. Leadership is about saying, I think this, I feel this, I want to inspire, I want you to follow me. You know, a great friend of mine is Barbara Kellerman, the Harvard Kennedy professor, and she's written a bunch of books on leadership and what she calls followership. And, you know, be careful you're not the follower of a leader for its own sake. That's what I think. We are all responsible individuals, and we all now need to take this opportunity of the great reappraisal, the great reassessment. That's what I think this moment is, much more than the great resignation. Yes, there's been a lot of churn in jobs. There'll continue to be a lot of churn in jobs because of AI. But actually, we're all reassessing what is work to us. Can we live on what we're earning because of inflation? Do we want the commute? If we don't, are we going to move? What is our childcare? What are our caring responsibilities? What are our health needs? We are all workers and managers of our own lives. And unless leaders begin to think like they belong to the same class of worker as everybody else, I don't think they're going to be doing their job well enough.
Where do you see all this going next?
Do you mean the work stuff or the connected stuff?
I guess either. Like, they're related, right?
They are related. I think the turbulence is going to continue. I think we're in a period of turbulence and instability. In fact, I wrote one of my Bloomberg columns mentioning you and how what a cool customer you were when you arrived in Davos with the airline having lost your luggage, I believe. And in that column, I wrote about turbulence and said that I thought that the prevailing view amongst leaders, and I'm sure it will be again in the World Economic Forum next week, or in a couple of weeks, is turbulence. So where I see it going next is not what a lot of leaders long for, which is, could everybody just get back and behave now, please? Could everything just go back? That isn't going to happen. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, the reason why I mention Henry Ford a lot is because it cannot be overstated that this moment of generative AI and AI in general is the biggest shift in the story of work since mass automation and mass production in the early 20th century. And so we're going to see workplaces that are full of learning and connecting and making anew their mission. I think we're going to move out of the age of brand for its own sake. I think marketing and messaging it's never over, but it's peaking a bit. You know, social media doesn't feel the same as it did. Everybody's blaring out their branding, but what actually matters is knitting together connections and trust and meaning in the everyday, at C-suite level, at floor level, and in between. And anyone that doesn't think that's going to happen is misreading the fact that this is also the biggest generational shift in the workplace in 100 years. For the first time, you've got the ending of seven generations working alongside each other and the passing of the baton from, you know, the boomers, the X's, into what I call the amazing generation, partly because we're in an amazing era technologically, but partly because it's a sort of anagram of, you know, the alphas, the millennials, the Zs. These young people who have grown up with screens, they've grown up with touch screens, they've grown up with a fundamental different relationship to technology, to knowledge, to information, they are going to be the leaders in the next 15 years. By the middle of this century, you know, they'll all be leaders. We may live a 100-year life, but we aren't going to be the ones running the organizations. And it's going to be very different. So turbulence, change, and yet I think it's all great, or could be. I'm really optimistic about it because so much needed to change.
One thing I'd love to ask you about is that you believe there's a new type of worker, a flexitariat, on the horizon. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when I wrote my very first working assumptions column for Bloomberg, for their work shift section, I was asked, you know, what do you think's going on? Like, what's the trend? And I said then, and I've said it now as a trend for 2024, that the biggest trend is not whether you're a white collar worker or a blue collar worker, but how you work and the skills that you need. And generally speaking, we are all much more flexible gig and solopreneur than we were. You can just see that in the trends, whether it's World Bank data looking at developing economies or America. You know, more and more people work freelance or independent. That's partly the economics driving it, and it's partly and increasingly preference. So the flexitariat is obviously, you know, everyone's heard of the proletariat. It's referencing a kind of worker, but it's a worker that really puts choice and flexibility and mobility at the heart of what they do. And that isn't to be feared by leaders. It's to be understood and it's to be embraced. And whisper it quietly, most leaders are flexitariats in their hearts too.
And I know you've talked about this as the most interesting time in the last 100 years. Is that why you say that? Or
yeah. And I think it's because, you know, you asked me before about what is social health, and social health is a movable term that I use to describe the different ways in which humans connect to each other and to the technology at their disposal. And the fact of the matter is that the workplace was not healthy before the pandemic. The World Health Organization declared stress an epidemic in 2019. It declared stress as a contribute, and stress, and the data shows that they mean workplace stress as a large element of it, and that workplace stress and stress was a contributory factor to disease. We know, and there are much, much better people to articulate this than me, like Jeffrey Pfeffer at Stanford University, for example, that there is just an absolute link between toxic, bad management and poor performance and illness. We need not kid ourselves that the world of work was rosy and fabulous before the pesky pandemic came along. So I see this as an opportunity and a reckoning to grasp the nettle. And the other thing I do, and I'm just writing my new book called Working Assumptions, What We Thought We Knew Before COVID and Generative AI About the Pandemic and What We Know Now. And the truth is that it's in plain sight, the disaffection that has been there. Work was not working well. Now, that isn't to say that I'm anti-work. In fact, I clash with people who argue that wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to work at all? And a lot of technologists are of the view that, oh, you know, generative AI, it's going to take away our need to work. Well, I'm afraid I'm not keen on that. I think work's important to people. So I'm very pro-work, but I'm not pro-work that doesn't work. That's kind of my mission, is I want work to work.
As you know, the topic of this podcast is Let Go and Lead, and we've talked about that a little bit already. Is there anything else beyond what you've already talked about that you feel is really important for leaders to let go of?
I think I've talked a bit about what they need to let go of. They need to let go of hubris and, you know, rules and mores and ways of doing things that don't necessarily work. But I want them to pull towards them something, actually. I want leaders to pull towards them a curiosity to see what else is out there, to buddy up with organizations, institutions, case studies from the vaults. Academia is stuffed full of fabulous working papers that, you know, haven't seen the light of day for an extremely long time. And, you know, to look for the bright spots. One of my favorite business books is The Switch by the Chip brothers, Chip and Dan.
Oh, yeah.
How small change makes big change happen. And it's a wonderful, simple theory called the bright spot theory. And the bright spot theory is, never mind what isn't working, find something that is working. And I want leaders to pull towards them. Who is the person in the office that looks happy? Who's the person delivering great work who's not in the office? Who could inspire you to understand more what's going on? Don't just rely on feedback surveys and, you know, polling is fine, but sometimes people give answers they think are required of them. Really convene talking shops, sharing shops, and also be decisive and try things out and be prepared to flip and say, you know, we've got the lease on this building for X number of months or years, and this is what we're going to try out with it. Just as there's going to need to be a chief AI officer, you know, there probably needs to be a chief turnover officer. There probably needs to be a chief culture officer. You know, we need to rethink the board for sure. So embrace the new and let go of the stuff that you know in your heart of hearts doesn't really work.
Well, Julia, this has been absolutely fantastic. I just have to thank you so much for your time. It's been great.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be asked to be on the show. I just want to make one slight apology in that I'm a little entrepreneur. I'm not somebody that leads vast, complex organizations. And I know that many, many leaders are fabulously innovative and brave and courageous. I think they need to speak out. I think we need to hear from the leaders who say, I did this in Idaho. I did this in Singapore. I did this in Birmingham. And I did this in this industry. And I did this with this cohort. And we need a global movement of leaders, actually, just at the same time that I do think we need to localize how we do things. So I'm grateful for the opportunity. And I feel a little bit humble that, of course, anybody looking up my resume will know that I'm not a a grown-up leader like many of your listeners and viewers. So thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed my conversation with Julia. From studying global trends that shape our work practices to exploring the intricate relationship between people, technology, and our working lives, Julia offers a perspective that combines realism with a vision for the future. She reminds us that as the nature of work and technology evolves, so must we. We're on the brink of seeing a generation emerge into leadership roles with a fundamentally different relationship to technology and information, which promises to redefine leadership as we know it. She believes leadership education, even the traditional MBA, is going to change drastically in future years. Julia also brought up the role of social health in the workplace, in other words, how humans connect to each other and to technology in a way that's productive and fulfilling. Pre-pandemic, the workplace was far from perfect, with stress considered a global epidemic. Julia reminds us the pandemic presented an opportunity, a reckoning, to reset our work environments and our approach to stress. We need work that actually works. She says leaders should embrace curiosity around change, including recognizing the flexitarian or flexible worker is a significant force in the future of work. And since the title of this podcast is Let Go and Lead, I asked her what leaders should let go of. Julia encourages us to let go of outdated hubris, rules, and ways of doing things that don't necessarily work today. She encouraged us not to look around at what other companies are doing, but figure out what we need for our own business. It isn't one size fits all. It's let's find out what works best for each unique situation. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Julia as much as I did, and hope it inspires you to embrace curiosity and change in your own leadership journey. Remember to subscribe to Let Go and Lead on your favorite podcast platform, and be the first to hear conversations and ideas from other thought-provoking leadership champions, including Kate O'Neill, Mark Miller, and Bonnie St. John. And don't forget to check out archive interviews with Marshall Goldsmith, Howard Schultz, Seth Godin, and others. Thanks for joining, and see you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.